last night. We came close to having throat cancer, but it got to the point where he said, if I cut on your one good vocal cord anymore, you could lose your voice. And I said, well, then we'll roll with this, you know, because I can still talk. I can still close deals. But my sobriety, I've been sober for 5 days and 37 years. I heard Ken must be March 21st because he said 6 days and 31 years. But my sobriety day is March 22nd of 1985. And that just blows me away. That's just kind of a long time between cocktails when you think about it. I mean, and it wasn't like when I got here, anybody was looking at me going, oh, now this guy here, he's really going to make it. You know, I mean, I was hanging on by my fingernails for a long time. And then, you know, you look up and time passes and things come along. My home group is the primary purpose group, Alcoholics Anonymous, in Austin, Texas. I live in Austin. I grew up in I grew up in Dallas. But I've been in Austin since I came down here and drank myself out of the University of Texas in 1977. And other than a couple of trips back to Dallas, I've been here pretty much ever since. My sponsor is Myers Raymer. And then my wife is Katie. And my wife, I love that I've got 37 years now because there's a big problem in our household. My wife has 5.5 months more than I do, and she makes a big deal out of it. I mean, in fact, there's times if I'm pissed off or struggling, she'll say, honey, just hang in there for 5 more months and it'll all start to make more sense to you, you know. But we have a good time here, and AA is alive and well in our house. And I really thank you for letting me join you guys this morning. I mean, because Tarik and I, yeah, we go way back to that. I'll never forget that that first trip. I'd never been to a monastery either, you know, and it's a contemplative monastery where they're generally quiet, you know, like they spend the whole time quiet, except, at the beginning of the deal, you know, they go, now, generally, our meal times are silent, but since you guys have the whole facility, you can vote on whether you want to be silent or talk. And I was like, no, I want the whole, you know, monastic experience, dude, you know. So I voted silent. And Katie's like, what? What are you talking about? But it voted silent. And then, of course, we wanted to talk the whole weekend. And they had one little room down the hall where you could talk. And I'd try to go down there, and Katie'd run me out of there. Because, oh, no, Mr. Monastic, you know, you can go sit in the big room. I mean, we had a lot of funny stories. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to talk about today. I'm real happy to be with you guys, but if you give me too much leash, I'll wander all over the place. But hopefully I don't get wrapped around a pole here. But there were so many funny stories that came out of that weekend in that monastery. I mean, but at one point, now Katie and I were best friends for 20 years. We got sober together. I was at her wedding. We were literally like brother and sister for 20 years. And then her husband passed away. Her husband had a brain tumor, and he survived that, but he relapsed behind all the medication. And you know, there's a thing on page 14 where it says, for an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, he cannot withstand the certain trials and low spots ahead. And Joe wound up relapsing behind all that surgery and medication, and died of a heroin overdose with 23 years of sobriety. And really tragic. It was like having somebody blown out of the foxhole right next to you, you know, because we had all been litter mates. And I never dreamed that Katie and I would, there was no flirtation or sexual innuendo in our relationship, mainly because Katie doesn't play that way. You know, I mean, it's kind of funny. The closest that I ever came to say anything inappropriate to her was one time we were talking about my sobriety date, And she said, it's March 22nd. She goes, you know, your sobriety date's the same day as my naked birthday. I said, really? We should celebrate together. I said, I'll stay sober. And she goes, Charlie, you know, I was like, sorry, Katie, you know, I mean, but back to this giving each other shit all the time. We're at that monastery with Tarek and Scott and all those guys. And I go in, I mean, Katie has seen me warts, hairs and all, you know, and I mean, I'm a walking example, I hope, of the concept that God uses broken people to do his work, because that's all he's got to work with. But I mean, I don't pretend to be a spiritual giant a lot of times, but I try to be pretty engaged in this process. But we go in for mealtime, and I don't know where they were keeping the butter, but these little pats of butter were hard as a rock. And so I get, now the food is pretty sparse at a monastery. I mean, when we went in there, we're not talking chicken fried steak and mashed potatoes or anything. There's this little bowl of weak ass soup and you got a roll and the butter. And so I go into the dining room, Katie comes in there, we're all quiet, you know, and I can't put this butter on my roll because it's hard as a rock. So I thought, well, I'll warm it up. And so I put the little pat of butter between my hands and I'm blowing on it. I'm warming it up in my hands like this when Katie comes out of the little cafeteria line and she sees me sitting there like that. And she goes, she has to mouth it. And she mouths, you are such a phony. And because I don't generally pray like that, you know, and I go, it's the butter. And I mean, you ever been in one of those places where you're not supposed to laugh? And, you know, I mean, we just about exploded because we're in this contemplative monster. We still call it the butter prayer, you know, but there was a lot of funny stories that came out that weekend. I mean, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what we get to talk about this weekend. I've got my regular talk, but I it feels different this morning, you know, and be interesting to see where we go. I grew up in Dallas, but I've been in Austin a long time. And I mean, I come from a relatively normal family. Let me get this where I can keep an eye on the clock, even though you said we don't have any time. I come from a pretty normal family, man. I mean, I grew up in the baby boom. I was born in 1956. I'm 65 years old. I've been in AA well over half my life, but I grew up in the 60s, and I missed out on the free love part of the 60s. I didn't get the benefit of any of that, but I did catch in on the tail end of all the drugs, but you know, I had a sister ahead of me that was a real high performer. I mean, anybody else grow up under the burden of potential? Anybody hear about that when you were growing up? Holy shit. I mean, that's all. My mother was a first grade school teacher. And all I ever heard about was, you know, if you could just apply yourself, you know, if you could, you know, I still don't know how to do that. You know, I mean, if you could just be more like the kid across the street, you know, I mean, Charles Mallier. And I mean, I was giving it the best I had, but I mean, I excelled in sports. I was a big kid. In fact, I drove by a baseball field the other day where I've been shopping for assisted living centers for my sainted 99-year-old mother. So she's 99, still lives in a 3,600 square foot house by herself. And we've been having to look at maybe elevating her care. So I was up in Dallas driving around and I drove past this baseball field where we used to, it was a big field where you got to play under the lights. And I remember when I was a kid, I was such a big kid, they made my mother bring my birth certificate to the baseball games because they didn't believe that I was 11. You know, they're like, he's 13 if he's anything. But I liked all that, you know, but it petered out all around junior high school. But, you know, there were some newer guys on the screen, and it kind of changed what I, some of the stuff I may want to talk about, because, you know, none of that stuff made me alcoholic. I think a lot of guys, when we get here, spend a good deal of time, you know, trying to figure out what is it that made me alcoholic? You know, was it, did I get too much of this or not enough of that? Or was it, you know, but, you know, I came to believe that it really isn't that important. You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of like if you're out hiking in the woods and you look up and there's a mountain lion getting ready to pounce on you. It doesn't really matter how he got there. You know, it's not like you're going to pause and go, well, that's peculiar. Mountain lions are not typical for this area. You know, I mean, it's like we got a problem we got to deal with, you know, and we got to move forward with it. But I mean, you know, I introduced myself as a recovered alcoholic. I don't think that's foreign for your guys probably, but I don't always say it. Like if I'm speaking at a bigger conference, I usually will say I'm Charlie Parker, I'm alcoholic. But later in the talk, I will circle back around and say, but I've been given the greatest gift that God can grant an alcoholic of my variety, and that's recovery from this hopeless state of mind and body that's described in the foreword to the first edition of the Big Book. Because sometimes I worry that if I, in a big room, I got a big audience and a lot of people that are struggling, and sometimes I worry about turning off my target audience. You know, the exact people that I'm trying to talk to are the ones that are going to, you know, it doesn't take much to set us off, you know, and you know, I remember when I was, you said we can talk about drugs and stuff. When I was in treatment, this guy came in and he was talking. He goes, I was such a needle freak. I used to shoot water. And I thought, oh, bullshit. You know, who shoots water? And then he goes, I know it wasn't nothing but water because I'd beaten those cottons so many times that there wasn't anything in them. I went, oh, well, when you put it like that, you know, maybe I did shoot a little water, you know, but I thought it had a little color to it, you know, but, I mean, but you know, I mean, we'll pick any little thing to separate us from people, you know, and so I'm careful sometimes about, because one of the things I noticed in AA is that whenever we form a firing squad, we always form a circle. And we got some of our best members picking each other off over whether it's recovered or recovering or sponsee or protege or twofold illness or threefold illness. And, you know, and lose sight of the big picture. But, you know, one thing Mark Houston was my sponsor, and I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years of sobriety. And a lot of that had to do with a bottom I hit, and it also happened to do with Mark Houston coming into my life, you know, not too long after that. But I mean, Mark used to say, don't let anyone read your big book for you. And so, you know, if somebody wants to say recovered, whatever, rock on. But, you know, when we talk about having recovered, what are we talking about? And it's in that foreword of the first edition. You know, most of the time in the book when it says we, for a long time I never asked myself who we is, but the we that it's generally referring to is listed in that first paragraph of the foreword of the first edition where it says we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from what? From a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So the book is, for the most part, is written from their perspective. They're saying, we did this, we learned that, we discovered that, we took, you know, and there are sometimes when that's important to know, because like, you know, in those promises that they read in a lot of meetings, they call them the promises, or the promises that come after the ninth step. There's a part of it, you know, where it says, are these extravagant promises? And don't get me started about people chanting in AA meetings. I mean, you know, it's, you know, when something is weird in AA is when they didn't do it when you got here and they've started doing it since you got here. Then it feels weird, you know, I mean, because like when I got to AA, we'd join hands and we'd do the Lord's Prayer and people would go, keep coming back. All right. Okay, that's kind of cool. Keep coming back. And then over a period of time, it's like, keep coming back. It works. you know. And then eventually says, keep coming back. It works. If you work it, it's worth it. So work it. And I'm like, oh, come on, man. I mean, we look like a bunch of jackasses in here. You know, I mean, I always picture this old dope fiend coming in going, God dang, I want to get clean and sober, but do I really have to do all this, you know, shave and haircut, two bits, you know, and all this crap. But I mean, now then they started chanting the last line of when they read How It Works, you know, God could and would if he were soft. And then now they chant the last line of the traditions. And, you know, I wanted to just start doing some random chants out loud while they're reading you know, just like I got Tourette syndrome or something, just blurt stuff out, you know. But I mean, all everything I'm saying is, with the chanting in there, you don't have to do it. You can do it if you want, but it's not required. I mean, you know, turns out, amen is a kick-ass way to end the prayer. You know, I mean, we're the only group of people that take the Lord's Prayer and go, you know what, man, I think we can put a cooler ending on this than Jesus did, you know. but I mean, I'm just saying, what the hell made me say that? I was talking about what have we recovered from, and that thing when it says a hopeless state of mind and body, because I like to talk a little bit about what it means to be an alcoholic, you know, because I spent a good deal of time sitting in. Now, when I first came in back in end of 83, I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and eventually Overeaters Anonymous. I've been to some Sex Addict Anonymous meetings. I've been to Gamblers Anonymous meeting. I qualify in a lot of rooms. You know, I mean, you know, I hear people talking about being double winners. I'm like, screw that. I'm probably an octo winner, you know. I mean, but the thing we've got to watch out for is going to 8 different fellowships, getting 8 different sponsors, not working 96 steps, you know, and I'm still just as screwed up as a wood watch because, you know, I haven't done the recovery process in any of them, you know. But I like to talk, and we like to talk, but this is a program of action. You know, I spent a good deal of time in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, raising my hand, saying, my name is Charlie, I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't really know what it meant. I figured if there is such a thing as an alcoholic, I must be one, because I didn't know anybody that drank more than I did. You know, the shortest version of my story is that the guys that I drank with thought I did too much dope. And the guys that I did dope with were shocked by my drinking, you know. So everybody, I never get to tell this story. But one time I stand in the kitchen with this 6'5" heroin dealer that I used to buy from. And we're in his kitchen, and there was a half gallon of vodka with the annoying little plastic thing pulled out of the top so you could get to it. And I had a little glass of orange juice. And I took a sip of orange juice and a big pull of vodka, a sip. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning. Took a sip of orange juice, big pull of vodka, a sip of orange juice, big pull of vodka. Did that about 3 times. And he's standing there next to me. He goes, damn. And I look at him. I go, oh, from you, I'm going to get shame. You know, God almighty, I'm used to it from my mother or my sister, but from my heroin dealer, I'm going to get shame. You know, come on, man. I mean, so it's like everybody thought that I got way too loaded. By the time I got to AA, there wasn't anybody that was surprised that I was here nobody said, oh, wow, I didn't know you had a problem, you know, or anything like that. I was, you know, but some of these terms, from the very early on, I had no way of separating alcoholism and drug addiction. To me, it was all one event. I was about getting loaded, and there were periods, you know, one that you hear terms in AA that you don't hear on the street. And one of the things that really amused me when I got here was the term drug of choice. Anybody hear that one? You know, Mark used to talk about your drug of no choice, but drug of choice always kind of tickled me, you know, because it implies that I'm some kind of flipping connoisseur, you know, that's going to be sitting over at somebody's house and, you know, you pull something out of your shirt pocket. I go, what is that? Oh, no, that's not my particular drug of choice. You know, you boys go ahead. I'll sit over here and wait for my DOC to appear. You know, I mean, it's like, whatever you got will be fine. You know, it's like, we'll go as long as I can move away from the way I feel right now. I'll go up, down, sideways. And I was always overshooting the mark. I was always trying to find different things. And hopefully, now I'm going to tell you now before I forget about it. There are times when I'm talking where I'll say, we'll get back to that later. And what that means is that this isn't the appropriate time to talk about that little piece of information. But when I tell you we're coming back to it, we're probably not coming back. I mean, I always get real excited if I actually circle back around to one later, you know. But I mean, you know, it turns out that as an alcoholic, I got two problems with alcohol. It's hard to do this on the screen. One happens to me when I drink it, and the other one happens to me when I don't drink it. Other than that, I don't struggle with alcohol. It only gives me trouble when I'm drinking it or when I'm not drinking it, you know? And it's, now this is with alcoholism, but I mean, it's really important to be able to break down to a guy what it means to be alcoholic, you know? Because sometimes in the rooms of AA, we assume that everybody out there knows what we're doing in here, knows what they got, and they're just choosing not to avail themselves of it. But I'm telling you, the whole time I drank and used from the time I was, well, my first drink was at 13, but I really didn't get going good till I was probably 16. It's not like, but I can tell you this, there were a lot of people that held it together a lot better than I did. I'd like to tell you that I drank a fifth of whiskey every day from the time I was 16 till I was 28. I don't think that's true. But the thing I can tell you is absolutely true for me is I never turned down the opportunity to get loaded one time under any circumstances. There, I don't ever remember saying, no, it's my mom's birthday, you know, or I have an appointment tomorrow or anything like that. I also don't ever remember being in a bar and having the bartender go, can I get you another one? And going, no, I think I'm good. You know, I don't ever remember getting to a point where I go, let's stop right here. You know, it's funny, I was talking, this is fun. I get to talk about stuff. But I mean, when I came into AA, I was hanging out with all these dope fiends and addicts and stuff. And I would hear guys talking, or sometimes even when I was using, I would hear some of these heroin addicts talking about, I was a heroin addict, talking about keeping a wake up shop, you know, and that just seemed so adult and manageable to me. I mean, it was foreign to me because I'm like, if you still got a shot left, why would you go to bed? You know, I mean, we always stayed up till everything was gone. And then the next morning, you're scrambling and scuffling, trying to come up with money to get through the day. I mean, but let me get back to what it means to be an alcoholic. The first piece is this, the book does a beautiful job of describing this in the doctor's opinion and the first 44 pages of the book. But on page 30, it says, our founders had learned that they had to fully concede to their innermost selves that they were alcoholic. This is important if you're one of the guys on the screen counting days. They had learned that they had to fully concede to their innermost selves that they're alcoholic. It says it's the first step in recovery. Well, there's a lot going on in that sentence, but I can't fully concede to my inner. There's a big thing that happens when my alcoholism goes from between my ears down into my heart, you know, and being able to have that experience, we call it a first step experience. When I sit down with a new guy, my first job is to give them what I call a step one experience or a fatal dose of alcoholism, right? Because it's so important. And you know, out of all our whole recovery programs in the first 103 pages of the book, and they spend about two-thirds of that. You know, they spend about over half of it talking about step one. You know, it's that important. And so, because sometimes I think it's a mistake to assume that, I think in AA sometimes they throw the doors wide open and a guy gets kind of squeezed down into nothing. But if we take a minute and let a guy figure out, when it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to things to get it, he doesn't know what we have. And he doesn't even know what he has. But if you can give him a crushing dose of alcoholism, it tightens the doors up a little, but it opens up into everything. Because I have a motivation driven by this first step experience. And it turns out, you know, the first piece, I'm going to try to go fast, but the first piece of it is the physical reaction. And it says in the book that I don't respond normal to alcohol. My sister's not alcoholic. I watched her drink. She does not drink like we do, you know. And I have a reaction to alcohol that ain't regular. And the book calls it this phenomenon of craving. Now, it's all on Roman numeral 28. That's a page in your book that needs to really show somewhere, you know, because we spend a lot of time on this page right here where it says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to these class. This class, what class? This class of chronic alcoholics. Now this thing, it says that this manifestation of an allergy is just an abnormal physical reaction, and manifest means the way it shows up, right? I'm also allergic to poison ivy. And the way that allergy manifests is I break out in a rash. It's like a bastard and it spreads all over me and that sort of thing. That's what, well, how does my allergy to alcoholism manifest, or alcohol manifest? And it's in this phenomenon of craving. The tricky thing about the phenomenon of craving is I never went on a run and thought, oh, I've triggered a phenomenon of craving, right? I just thought I'd change my mind. Right? You ever think, I'm just going to go have a couple with the guys after work, you know, and then after two, you go, you know what? I think I've changed my mind. Two is a bad number, you know? I think I'll have seven. I think, you know, seven is a good number. I'll never forget, we were in Vegas one time at this sober house. We went with Bob D to go out to this sober house. When I got sober, they call them halfway houses. They call them sober houses now. And there was this guy in there that didn't have a lot of time. And I just fell in love with him because he was so unfiltered. And we're talking and he goes, man, it sucks that I'm an alcoholic. And he goes, I wish I wasn't an alcoholic so I could just have like seven drinks, you know? And I thought, that is my man right there, you know? Not one, not two, seven, you know? And he's grieving. Because he's got alcoholism, because like, of all the diseases I could get, you know, why couldn't I be lactose intolerant, you know, or something? I mean, the one thing I love to do, why do I have to be allergic to that? You know, I mean, it's like, I gave you my milk without grieving, you know, but vodka, come on, you know, but I mean, it's like this craving is a huge problem. I mean, that when I drink, it triggers a craving for more booze. The first drink calls for the second drink, and the seventh drink feels like a better idea than the second drink does. And I'm up on a run, and I don't know exactly how it got started. But, you know, the most important thing you can do with anything the book says or anything I say is compare it to, hold it up against your own experience and see if it's a fit. Is this what happens when I got loaded? Is this how it went for me? Because whenever I would start, but here's the thing, this craving is a big problem, but it's not my biggest problem. If my biggest problem was what happens when I take a drink of vodka, my solution would be real simple. Just be, don't drink vodka, right? But here comes the second piece of alcoholism, and that's this mental obsession. And that's the thing that my mother never understood. My mother used to shake her finger and go, you are such an idiot. You drink every day. And I remember, see, the thing is, she doesn't understand. I'm thinking, Mom, everybody I know drinks every day. You know, I don't hang out with people that don't drink every day. And what I didn't know to tell her was, is if drinking did for you what it does for me, you'd be stupid not to drink every day. And why would you ever set that down? You know, I mean, and so, but the second piece of this thing is that I don't get okay. What she didn't know is that I don't get okay when I stop drinking. My problems don't go away when I stop drinking. In fact, it feels like now I get arrested less and that sort of thing. But the internal stuff, it's like somebody cranks up the volume on me. You know, I start getting restless. I start getting irritable. I start getting discontent. I am much more prone to violence 2 or 3 weeks away from a drink than I am when I'm drinking. You know, because I don't, you know, it's like the idea of dragging somebody out of their car in traffic occurs to me a lot more when I'm restless, irritable, and discontent than it does when I'm loaded, you know? And I'm the guy that I'm in the grocery, you give me a couple of weeks without a drink, and I'm in the grocery store in a 14 item lane or 10 item lane, and the guy next to me's got 14 items on the belt. And I'm like, so, Paola, which 4 of those items are you going to put back? You know, and if he comes back with the wrong answer, it's a bad day at the grocery store. And I'm trying to figure out how to explain to my family that I got arrested going to get milk, you know, but it's like, by God, there's chaos in society and somebody's got to, you know, hold the line. Now, here's the other thing, though. I've learned, I'm also a big hypocrite, you know, and I love double standards, you know, so don't step to me when I got 14 items on a 10 item lane, because I got a story to go with. I always got a story to go with my stuff. You know, now you, I demand justice. Me, I got a story to go with it. This is a recurring theme you got to watch for in inventory. It's funny. I got a guy I've been sponsoring a few years. He's got 20 something years. And he was telling me a story about a thing that happened at work, you know, and he gave the whole long story. And I went into pages 60 to 63 and started talking about where he set the ball rolling and where he made decisions based on self and how thoughtless and inconsiderate his take was. And he goes, okay, look, I'm going to tell this story one more time. And I need you to pay attention really closely because this is really simple. You know, it's like, I do not like your take on it at all, you know, because he had this big story shape where it made him look like the victim. And I can't tell you how many times we come into inventory with resentment, see it from an entirely different angle in this process. And I go out the other end of the inventory process with an amends to go back. It happens over and over and over. If I'm going to be free, the problem's got to be me. We call it a race to be wrong. You know, the biggest move that a guy can take in Alcoholics Anonymous, other than connecting with God, is when we see that my problems aren't coming at me, they're coming from me. That my outward conditions are always a demonstration of my inward situation. You know, I keep trying to get things straightened out here. And then I think I'll be okay if I can just get this in order and this in order and this in order and this in order. You know, when Bill talked about take away my problems, root and branch, I spend all my time trimming the branches. You know, if I can just get her to act right and get the money in the bank and get this, but it turns out, in fact, you can spend so much energy trimming the branches that you don't have any awareness of the root of the problem. And it's like whack-a-mole. I'm always just trying to fix this, fix that, fix that. And I can't figure out why I feel like kicking the dog, you know? So the second piece of that alcoholism is this mental obsession. And I get so uncomfortable sober that eventually I need relief. And when I need relief, you can't tell me to think the drink all the way through or anything like that because I'm not capable of that. But I need relief. And it may not work well now, but it worked once. And if the only tool I have is a hammer, after a while, everything starts to look like a nail. You know, and I get so uncomfortable that what happens is, this is the whole first step thing. is that I get caught in this terrible cycle of alcoholism where I drink and I trigger the phenomenon of craving. Now I'm on a run and things are going. And after a while, things start getting really rough. And I get, it gets so rough that I either have to stop or I get stopped. Now I've stopped and things are, you know, and I'm going along and things are getting a little better. You know, it looks like maybe they're not going to fire me. Looks like she's not going to leave. I got a little fold of money in my pocket now. But after a minute, I start getting a little restless. I think that guy just gave me a look, you know, or I get irritable. And then I get, and eventually what happens, I get so uncomfortable that the mental obsession gets on me. And that makes me powerless over the first drink. So the thing I never understood about that mental obsession, the problem with alcoholism, it's not that I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop starting. And the thing I never considered is that every time I ever took that first drink, I was stone cold sober. That's the insanity of alcoholism that it's talking about, is that I make the decision to take that first drink stone cold sober. And I take this, so I drink until I have to stop. And then I stop until I have to drink. And that's the terrible cycle of alcoholism. And I've given that talk and being able to transfer that first step experience to somebody is just huge, you know, because all of a sudden you see these guys when they have a first step experience. I've seen guys, they lean forward in their chair at treatment, you know, and I work in construction. I'm not in the treatment business, but I've done a lot of meetings in treatment centers, and you see them when you set that hook. You see them lean forward and go, hold on just a minute. I've been in and out of AA for 18 years, and I've never heard the shit you're talking about. It explains an awful lot about what happens when I would start to get loaded, and it explains, more importantly, what happens when I swear to God I'm going to stop. AA is not for people that can make up their mind to stop drinking and pull it off. A guy that can make up his mind to stop drinking and pull it off doesn't even belong in AA. I mean, I don't care if he comes. I wish he wouldn't sponsor anybody and keep his mouth shut, because what works for him will kill a dope fiend like me. But AA is for guys like me that swear to God I'm not going to drink again, and I drink again, and I drink again, and I drink again. Well, I got sober in 85, and I got a lot of ground to cover in the 3 hours we have left together this morning. But, you know, I mean, I want to fast forward ahead, because the cool part of my story, what I think is, I came in today and I was going to a lot of meetings, and I love the fellowship. I was very fortunate because I have always love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the meetings. I love the people. I see 8 guys on this group that I can tell I went to drink with. You know, and you know, it's funny. That's my highest compliment in AA now, is I had a drink with that guy. You know, I mean, because it's not everybody in AA. There's some guys I met in AA where I go, I wouldn't have drank with that son of a bitch if he had a keg in his living room. You know, I mean, you know, but God knows I judge no man, right? You know, but you know, not everybody fell in love. I thought everybody loved the fellowship like I did. And apparently that's not the case. And it's a great comfort, you know, when you feel like you're with your people and you know, when I was with Katie, we were doing all kind of cool shit, you know, when we were friends, you know, going tubing the river and going bowling and doing, and it doesn't sound, you know, like that exciting, but there was a lot of fellowship and stuff going on. And you know, I mean, I came to meetings, I got a sponsor, I worked the steps, and I thought I was a big book guy. I really did. My Tuesday night meeting was a big book study meeting, but I missed an awful lot. And you know, one of the things Mark used to like to say was, how do you know what you don't know? You know, and I mean, how could I possibly know what I don't know? And what, you know, sometimes I think we want to bash guys talking bullshit in the meetings, you know, like I have a terrible habit, it turns out, of judging people really harshly for not knowing something that I learned about 30 minutes ago. I mean, am I the only one? You know, where it's like, how can you be talking all that bullshit in these meetings? You know, when I did it, you know, for 17 years, you know, and so in our 10th step, it says our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And in my home group, we use, I've got this, this is a 1936 Webster's Dictionary that we use a lot at my meeting. I bought it off of eBay, and I would just, I'd search 1935 Webster's Dictionary. And if I didn't find one, I'd go to 36, 37, 38, 39, and find one. You know, they used to be about 10 bucks. I use the self-pronouncing Webster's Qualified Dictionary. But we like to look up words. And you know, it says our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness in the 10th step. And this is crazy. I looked up function one time in our meeting. You know what function, it says function means? It said expected duty. So like the function of this coffee cup is to keep my coffee in it and keep it hot. That's its function. That's what we expect it to do. What does it say our next expected duty is? To grow in understanding and effectiveness. So I got to think, when I was on the other side of this experience, how could you have approached me? How could you have come to me to tell me if I had something wrong in a way that was effective and without my ego going into self-defense? Because Mark used to say, if you come at me with something that differs from my belief system, or God forbid, you come at me with something that differs from what my beloved first sponsor told me, my ego goes into self-defense. And you know, because I only got two choices when you come at me with something like that. I can either consider what you're saying, or I can blow you up. And it's a lot easier just to blow them up, you know, go, ah, bullshit. You know, I mean, and that's, you know, and so we use the path of consideration. Do y'all talk about that, Terry? Yeah, you know, and it's just a way to circumnavigate the ego, where you might be, if you say, I'd like to offer for your consideration that possibly, or is it possible that is a great term, you know, because it gives me a chance to consider something. And but man, I drifted for several years in my sobriety. I was really involved in the fellowship and everything for about the first 7 years. And then I went into a period that I kind of call a blank spot. I mean, I was still very much an AA member, and I was all about staying clean and sober and that sort of thing. But I mean, I wasn't going to as many meetings, and it's super common in AA. You know, we get sober, and all of a sudden, I got shit going on, you know, and I got a company, and I got a wife, and I got kids, and I got, and the gifts of sobriety can pull us away from this recovery process. And I, you know, I hit bottoms here and there. I hit bottoms at 4.5 years. I hit a bottom at 7 years. You kind of hit these walls, and but my biggest wall was at 17 years of sobriety, and I was in this. I kept blowing up marriages in my sobriety. I got married at 2.5 years, and I got that had blown up by the time I had 4.5 years, and we got a baby and you know, all this stuff. And so, but I waited the appropriate amount of time in AA to get in another relationship, right? 16 days, pow, I'm back into another relationship. And, you know, by the time a couple more years had gone by, I blew that one up. And I got another baby on the ground, and, you know, and my shit is not going the way I according even to my values, and I didn't know what was going on, and I was really in a lot of trouble, and you know, and I was in this third marriage with a hot shit Wall Street banker. We had a penthouse apartment in Manhattan. We had a beach house in the Hamptons. From the outside, everything looked really good, but it was probably the most dishonest relationship I've ever been in, you know? And the most dishonest thing about it was me. because she wasn't getting what she thought she was getting in that marriage. And when Katie's husband died, she caught me at a weak moment. And that was the end of that marriage to the woman in New York. But what happened about that time was I was in a plane crash. We chartered a plane to fly from the Hamptons into New York City. This was July 20th, 2003, and we're flying out over Long Island. It's about 9:30 at night, and it's a charter plane, a little Cessna 210 with retractable landing gear. And the engine quit like somebody had turned the key off and thrown it out the window. I mean, all of a sudden, it just goes from this roaring engine to we're in a glider, and we're about 3,500 feet in the air, and I'm in the co-pilot seat. Now, I'm not a co-pilot. You know, but I'll never forget, I pick up the headphone, and I've said this 100 times, but what you don't want to hear your charter pilot saying when you put the headphones on is he's over there jacking this knob up a dashboard going, come on, come on, come on, come on. And I'm like, oh, shit. And they come on the radio and they said, you're cleared to Gabretzky. Now, there was an airport at our 10 o'clock, and I could see the runway. I could see the runway lights, but we're not going to make it. We're over the water. We're not going to clear the water. We're not going to clear the trees. We're damn sure not going to make this runway. And he says, you don't understand. I've lost engine power. I can't make land. I'm going to have to ditch. And I'm like, I'm a gambler my whole life. Right. You know, what are the odds that the first time I ever charter an airplane, we're going to set the son of a bitch down in the water at night, you know? And he says, brace for impact. Anybody know how to do that? You know? So I go, how? And he goes, put your hands on the dashboard. And so I put my hands on the dashboard and we come in and he turned towards these lights on the shore and we come in, boom, we hit the water. And it's like splashed down at Six Flags times 1,000. I just remember seeing white water spray and noise, and windshield comes in, and then absolute silence. And all of a sudden, I'm like, holy shit, I think we're all right. You know, it stayed upright. We had a nice belly landing. And right about that time, I felt something on my knee. And I'm like, turns out this wasn't much of an airplane. Really shitty boat. It's going down and the water goes whoop, like that. And I realized that I can't get my door open and the water goes up and the roof, I go up to get some air and there's nothing but water and the roof of the plane. And I'm like, that's what I thought. So this is it. We died today in this goddamn airplane. And spoiler alert, I didn't die, but I go back underwater and I start jacking the door of this airplane, door, and it comes open. You know, turns out you got to wait for the pressure to equalize. And yeah, well, guess what? Didn't know that, you know, all you're thinking is I can't get this door open, you know, and I get the door open and I grab the roof of the plane and I pull it. When I felt my feet pull free, I'd like to tell you my first thought was of my wife or the dog, right? There were 5 adults and a dog. But my first thought when I felt my feet come loose was I'm out, you know? And I went up and I got some air and I came back down and pulled my wife out. And then I went back down and got the dog out. And it turns out the only non-survivor was the pilot and his other couple went out the other side. I see 5 heads in the water and I go, where's the dog? And they go, in the plane. And so I go back in to get the dog. Now, the whole time I think, turns out that the plane's sitting on the bottom. We're only in about 11 or 12 feet of water. But I'm thinking the whole time that it's about to go to the bottom. You know, so I'm not willing to commit too much of myself into this to look for the dog. But I get my hand on the dog and pull it out. And the only non-survivor was the dog. The dog drowned and we got him. We did mouth to snout resuscitation, got him breathing again, but he died the next day. But anyway, it was pretty, you know, it's no Earl Hightower story, But it was pretty flipping dramatic in my life. It got me looking at things differently. And I was on CNN with this little newbie reporter who was trying to make a name for himself at the time. He had a little show called Live from the Headlines with Anderson Cooper. And they sent a car for us, and I got to go on CNN. And, you know, my friends from all over the country going, is that Charlie? You know, but you know, I come back and I started, there's a whole lot of, life goes by pretty fast. You know, when I was telling my daughter this, you know, Sadie, when you're in your 20s and people say life is short, it doesn't mean shit. When you look up and you're 60 and you start going, good God, man, you know, we're only here for a minute, you know, but I started. A lot of the stuff that I've been fixing to do, they say that, and they say that in Alabama, you know, someplace you have to explain what fixing means. It means preparing to, you know, not repairing. You know, but I mean, there was a lot of stuff I was fixing to do. You know, I was probably going to get out of that marriage. I was probably going to, you know, do something. But now I'm starting, and I got out of that marriage, and I got into a relationship with Katie. And Katie and I have been a couple for 19 years now. It's the best period of my life in so many ways. But I mean, I start trying to pick up my program. I start going to the meetings and stuff. And the first thing that happened before I met Mark Houston, I had 12-stepped an old friend of mine that had relapsed and had a little pill problem. He was taking 125 Vicodin a day. And I went and 12-stepped him. It's funny, I called him on the phone. I was up in Dallas, and we're talking. I said, can I come by? He goes, no, it's not a good time. And I was like, okay. And so we talked for probably 25 minutes, and he goes, hold on, there's somebody at the door. And he goes to ask, he thinks it's the UPS driver bringing more Canadian pills to him. And he opens the door, and it's me, you know. And he goes, oh, you came over. You know, so we got him into La Hacienda Treatment Center, and he met this one-eyed guy named Chris Raymer while he was down there, and got really set on fire with a step one experience. And Chris told him, when you go to Dallas, you got to look up my brother Myers. And he started going to Primary Purpose Group. And we went up there, and we took a van load of people up to Primary Purpose Group because we were thinking about starting. It's funny because when we pull up, they go, what treatment center are y'all from? Because we're in a 15-passenger van, you know, bunch of, you know, drunks and dope. Like, no, we came up from Austin. But we started a group, and I started, you know, doing this thing, and I did inventory with Myers. But about that time, Katie and I saw this flyer. I had a friend call one time, and he goes, Charlie, I heard something about a big book step study up in Dallas. I said, let me look into it. I know some people in Dallas. And I saw this, somebody sent me this flyer, and it said Big Book Experience, Mark H. and this other guy. I don't want to say this other guy's name because he'd give a woodpecker a headache after about 30 minutes. And I mean, I went up there, and Mark's doing this workshop. And every time, and this guy kept interrupting Mark. And Mark, I felt a connection. I mean, it was so odd. Because I went to Katie and I go, I don't think this is what Dick was looking for, but I think we might enjoy this. This is, Mark sponsors Chris, and I really like Chris. You know, I bet we'd like Mark, and we'd like that. We drive 230 miles to go to this Big Book weekend. And I mean, not too long before that, I was sober, but I wouldn't have gone across town to go to a Big Book study, you know? And we go to this thing, and I mean, it was like, Mark said, I look like that guy. You ever see that Bose commercial where the guy's in his chair and his tie is blowing back this way, sitting in front of the speakers? And that's what I felt like this whole weekend. And this other guy kept interrupting Mark. And I was like, I wish you would shut up and let him keep talking. But when Mark, I just felt a connection that was so strong. And I meditated more that weekend that I had in my first 17 years of sobriety. I'm not bragging about that, but I don't think it's, I used to not like to talk about how much I missed in my earlier sobriety until I realized how much company I had. You know, there's a whole bunch of people that are having that same experience. And that's my target audience these days. But I mean, not too long after that, Mark says he's moving to Austin. And I said, are you gonna sponsor anybody? He said, I'm gonna take three guys. I said, could I be one of them? And he said, yeah. And man, there's a thing on page 100 where it says, when we look back, we see that the things that came to us when we placed ourselves in God's hands were greater than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I used to close AA talks with that because I thought it sounded spiritual and badass. But I mean, I'd read it 50 times before I saw the piece that said, when we look back, looking back on my life, then I can tell you that Mark Houston coming into our lives was a turning point in my sobriety. And it was like, and I found out later that Mark had gone silent for 3 years. And that workshop in Denton was the first thing he'd done. It was the first thing he'd done in 3 years. And it was like God saw Charlie and Katie, these guys are in fucking trouble. And he picked us up and brought us here and picked Mark Houston up and put us together. And looking back, the ripple effect of that meeting is mind-blowing. Because, I mean, my life exploded from that point, you know? And I come back and I say, it turns out, you know, because a lot of times, when a guy has been in AA for a while, or a guy's coming, you know, or the guy that's coming back to AA thinking, what's going to be different this time? You know, for most guys, coming back and doing AA means going back to those meetings and not drinking. And that'll keep a drunken dope fiend like me clean and sober right up to the point that I either drink or blow my brains out, because I got to have more than just not drinking. And man, it turns out to be able to tell that guy that there's more available than what he's been experiencing is a huge message. I don't know which is cooler, having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, or to be able to show somebody else how to have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, to have a new guy come in and go, you know, say, can you help me? Go, you have a big book? You know, if not, we'll get you one. You know, and like, let's sit down right now. We're going to talk about what it means. We're going to roll. That rolls us into the need for power. But then step one meant something different. I thought step three meant something way different than I thought it meant. And I don't have time to talk about it today. But now I think my sponsors must go, oh, Jesus, I got a sponsor. It's only read 3 pages out of the big book, you know, because we live in pages 60 to 63. And 84 to 88, and lots of other pieces. But I mean, the self piece that we talk about, I've never seen that chunk, because we went right from see that God could and would if he were sought to the third step prayer and skipped that chunk of work in pages 60 to 63. And if you skip it, it's not really that important. It's just the root of my problem and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life, you know? And so if you skip it, get back to us and let us know how it's going. You know, I couldn't figure out why I was always in beefs. It says on that basis, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good, right? I think I'm trying to do the right thing, but I'm blowing my shit up all the time. If you'd asked me what happened in that first marriage, I would have told you she cheated on me, and I don't roll like that. If you ask me now what happened in that first marriage, I would tell you that I exhibited a level of selfishness and self-centeredness in that marriage that would have driven anybody crazy and would have driven anybody out the door. That is a huge movement, because now I go from being victim to being, my problems are of my own making. Now, you know, so I wound up going back. Well, when I get with Mark, God dang, look at the time. I just want to hit a few more points. Mark comes into our house for our first meeting. We got a meeting just like this. We call it the Common Solution. And it's me and my boys. And the first time Mark came into it, we meet on Thursday night. He comes and he sits down. And, you know, my sponsees are kind of excited because Charlie's got a new sponsor. You know, where are we going? What are we doing? And, you know, when you get a new sponsor, what's the first thing you figure you're going to do? Right? For me, I figure we're probably going to write inventory. Right? Am I the only one that thinks like that? You know, Mark comes and he sits down at the table, and I'll never forget it. He goes, where are you guys at with the amends process? And we said what a drunk says when he's trying to think of an answer. We went, what? He goes, where are you guys at with the amends process? And I gave some bullshit answer, you know, because I mean, the truth was, I had done some amends, what we call the tornado amends. The first people touched by that tornado that I am going to sway through people's life, I had hit most of those, but I was amazed before I was halfway through and that list had made its way into a drawer. Mark's is down. Mark was very big about two words in the eighth step, all and all. Made a list of all pieces we'd harm, made amends to them all, and we're sitting down there, and Mark goes, I sense that there's a significant experience available for you men and me. Amends process. And we're like, how the fuck does he know that? I mean, it's like he's Svengali or something. So, you know, I never cuss, but I'm having a lot of fun doing it. Because we're like, how could he possibly know that? And it's because nearly all of the members of AA have a significant experience available in the amends process, you know? And we sit down and we start making amends cards. I was 17 years sober. I had 42 items. 42 amends cards to go make. And I'll never tell you I've made amends to everybody I've harmed, but I can tell you, sitting here this morning, I've made amends to everybody that I'm aware of harm. And you know, the things start to pop up as you roll along and then you'll clean those up. Well, I mean, so we start the meeting, we're all about, you know, doing consistent 10 steps, doing evening review in the 11th step, carrying that into morning prayer and meditation. Actually, my buddy Chris Schroeder up in New Jersey says we should put the word actually in front of the steps. It changes everything. You know, like actually continued to take personal inventory. No shit. I mean, like we really did it. You know, like actually made amends to all people we have harmed. You know, not just, you know, Mark used to talk about the guy sitting to me going, Mark used to say, I'm not interested in your experience on it. I'm not interested in your opinion on an experience you've never had. You know, so you got the guy sitting in the meeting going, well, I've never actually made amends to any all my people, but I have an opinion on the way I think it would go. And, you know, I don't find it necessary, you know, have that experience and then let's talk about it. You know, and I mean, but when we ran up against this self piece, we call it the second surrender. The first surrender in the program is to alcohol and drugs and whatever else brought me in. The second surrender is the surrender to self-will. And the self piece exploded my recovery package. Now it's all about where did I set the ball rolling? I've got to have somebody that's taken me to my, where did I make decisions? Where am I thoughtless, inconsiderate? Those sorts of things. Because, and I like to say that I'm in the entirely different angle business. When a sponsee calls me, I'm thinking, what's another way of looking at this, you know? And the reason I have to have 10-step buddy stuff is because I can hand it out to sponsees all day long, but I'm blind to it in myself. I'll call Mike Lorenz or Myers or Chad, and they hand it back to me just the way I've been handed it up because I can't see how selfish I am because of my motives and my delusion that I can spot it in them. So we keep this thing going. Well, I mean, the last 20 years, I've just been on fire with this deal, you know, and I almost missed it, but I mean, I'm sorry, guys. I got one more story I got to tell about in October. I go to the, I assume we're all Dallas Cowboy fans here. I've got season tickets to the Cowboys on the 50-yard line. It's bucket list stuff. If you see a Cowboy game and they show Jerry Jones and sitting in his box, I'm right there. I've sit 3 feet in front of Jerry Jones. I got this bucket list ticket, and you know, crazy parking spot and owner's club and all this shit. In October, Katie and I go up, we're going to go to a Monday night football game. And we're there at my mom's house, and I go, I look and I go, Katie, you know, the state fair is open and the game's not till 7:30 tonight. Let's go push mom around the state fair, get a corn dog. Corn dog was invented at the Texas State Fair. They're amazing. And so I go to get a corn dog, and we're walking around this building, that building, automobile building, that sort of thing, pushing my mom in a wheelchair. And we come up on this one booth, and they got all this Dallas Cowboys stuff in. And I started talking to the guy, and, you know, life-size images of guys that endorse their product. And I go, what are you guys doing? And he goes, we are a company called Advanced Body Scan, and we do preemptive healthcare screenings, you know, CT scans, MRIs, blood panels, carotid artery scans, stuff like that. Katie perks up. She says, you know, I'm interested in this. I want to do this. So we sign up, and 3 weeks later, we go back up for another Cowboys game, and we stay over and go to their hospital on Monday. And I get we sit through an amazing sales pitch and sign up for this little package. And the next morning, I go get then we go down that morning and get a CT scan. I'm feeling great, man. I mean, they called 2 days later on my 65th birthday, and they said, Mr. Parker, this is the physician's assistant from Advanced Body Scan. I'm looking at your scan. He says, there is a sizable mass in your liver. I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, it's like 11 centimeters. I'm like, holy shit. He goes, yeah, it's like 5.5 inches. And we can't rule out carcinoma or anything. So next thing you know, I'm getting MRI scan, an MRI with contrast. And then he says, we need a biopsy. And they get the biopsy and they come back and they go, well, yeah, it's, sure enough, it's hepatic carcinoma. You got liver cancer. And it was about that big. It wasn't this big. It was about that big. And in the middle of my liver. And I'm having my 65th birthday party thinking, I wonder if this is my last birthday, you know? But I got a lot of faith in God. And, you know, it's amazing. In the third step, it says we will begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. I mean, if you ever want to have an unpopular topic, I was telling Chad, I go, I don't think I've ever heard of anyone. They go, today we're going to talk about the hereafter, you know, but I mean, or fear of it anyway. But I'm going into this surgery and I'm not too scared. You know, there's a part of me that thought it would really suck to die right now because I'm 65. I got money in the bank. We just bought a motorhome and a dog, and we got friends all over in AA. And we got this shotgun hobby. Katie and I are both competitive shotgun shooters. And we go to a lot of tournaments and stuff, and, you know, sporting clays. And it would suck to die right now, you know, because everything's kind of pretty awesome right now. You know, 1 year with, I bought that Cowboys package, is a 19-year package. And I'm like, no shit, one year, you know, is what I get. Well, we meet the surgeon we go in and he says, I can treat it. I want to treat it with curative intent. And I'm like, good. And they go in on January 19th, they took out 60% of my liver. And when I wake up, the surgeon is just ecstatic. He's like, we got it all. We got clean margins. It has not spread anywhere. I mean, you are cancer free, you should see the chunk of liver they took. I'm a big boy, but I mean, they took out a 4.5 pound chunk out of the middle of my liver. And if you flip it over, I got a picture of it. You can see the tumor right in the middle of it. But, you know, I'm not going to tell you, I'm not a prosperity preacher or anything. I'm not going to tell you that if you pray hard enough or you just believe that you'll be cured of cancer or that you'll get the big job or whatever. But I can tell you that a connection with God, like I've established in this program, we'll make it where you can walk into something like that and not be overwhelmed by fear. It was just, it was an amazing thing to experience and even to witness, because I was like, God, I'm in your hands, you know? And if this is the end of it, it's the end of it, you know, and everybody would be taken care of. But that was only 9 weeks ago, you know? And I've got a very impressive scar on my belly. I'm doing really good. I played pickleball this week. I've been getting back on the treadmill and that sort of thing. But I mean, I almost missed the whole deal. You know, I mean, if I died in that plane crash with 17 years, I would have thought I knew what AA had to offer me. And I'm telling you, I'd never stuck a toe in the water compared to the experience I'm having now. And then you find out that there's other pockets of enthusiasm, like you guys. Bob Bazan says, pockets of enthusiasm is Charlie's code for people that are doing it right. And I'm like, yeah, it kind of is, you know, because there's plenty of people fucking it up. You know, I mean, there, and if you get out in mainstream AA, if you go out, you start talking about the solution the way we're doing it, people perk up. People, real alcoholics are drawn to real solution. You know, and the next thing you know, people, I've worked with guys with 20, 30 years, they have this new experience. All of a sudden, people are coming up asking them to sponsor them when they've shared for 20 years. And I always say, if you're sharing in every meeting you're going to and nobody's ever asking for your phone number, might be an untreated alcoholism, you know, because real alcoholics are drawn to real solution. And I love this program. I love being with guys that are doing it, you know, the way you guys are doing it, you know. And I mean, on page 152, there's a thing that says the most satisfactory years of our existence lie ahead of us. And I tell people all over the country, ask yourself, is that your experience? Is that your current belief? Does it feel like the most satisfactory years of our existence are ahead of us? Or does it feel like it petered out after a year or two in sobriety? If that's the case, get with somebody, get in this process, actually do the work, and it'll blow your head off. I'm Charlie Parker, I'm alcoholic.
Oh, wow. I can listen to you all day, Charlie. I loved it. Thank you so much for sharing your experience. We're all going to have these turning points in our path. And one of my turning points was, of course, listening to Mark on a CD called Hollow Bone. And then another turning point was finding this guy named Scott that was connected to Mark to work with me. But attending that weekend with Charlie and Katie was another turning point. And these turning points, they expand the idea of what's possible. Charlie alluded to it many times in his talk of, you know, there's, if you're doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous and our other sister fellowships, how can you get bored with this way of life? It is not possible to get bored. Mark used to say it all the time. How can you get bored with this way of life if you're actually living the way of life and not just talking about it? And we all need models of excellence. And I'm not trying to gas Charlie up, but he is, for me, an example of how to participate in this program and be a member in good standing. And he is one, in my opinion, a giant, and he's one of my heroes. And I know he doesn't want to hear me say this, but this is what the man has meant to me. And I'll forever be grateful to God and to you as well, Charlie. And thank you so much for sharing your morning with us. And with that, we're going to take a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you, gentlemen.
It's great.